content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Kiplinger Personal Finance, AARP Bulletin, and Money.com. First up is an article from AARP Bulletin entitled, Smart Money Moves to Fight Inflation. A grown-up's guide to investing, spending, staying calm, and securing your future during uncertain times. Soaring grocery bills, plunging stocks, record home prices, high interest rates. This year's financial jolts have bewildered and befuddled even seasoned money managers, which many of us older Americans certainly are. As we went to press, some rays of light were emerging. The stock market had regained some of its first half losses, and consumers' optimism about the future was edging upward. But a resurgence of inflation in August, after earlier signs of a slowdown, indicated that national and global economic problems wouldn't heal anytime soon. You can't change what's going on around you, but you can change how you think about it and what you do about it. To help calm your money worries, we've talked to financial professionals and other experts who can put today's situation in perspective and advise what to do and what not to do to shore up your financial security. Want some good advice about the economy, your retirement savings, and your spending? Imagine you went off the grid at the end of 2019, completely cut off from people and the news, as if on a desert island. You return to civilization nearly 3 years later to learn that the world is a hot mess. The worst global pandemic in a century, the highest inflation since the early 1980s, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, weather catastrophes everywhere, and profound political polarization and dysfunction here in the United States. You brace yourself for an update on your retirement stash, which you assume will be a hot mess too. But surprise, U.S. stocks actually gained 32.7% from the beginning of 2020 through the end of July. Bonds declined, but only by 2.74%. Since you had set your investment portfolio at a ratio of 60% U.S. stocks and 40% bonds, a common reasonable mix, you're up 17.4% over that period, compared with the 14.6% increase in consumer prices. In other words, you've beaten inflation. Not bad at all. 2.5 years is a fairly short time frame in investing, and the media often focuses on even shorter ones with news like the market dropped 4% in a single day, and stocks had their worst first half since 1970. But consider this, despite the market's poor performance so far this year, stocks have more than tripled over the past decade. What to do now? But yes, facts are facts. The stock market fell 23% from January through mid-June, putting it in a bear market territory. Despite a later recovery, it was down about 17% for the year as of mid-September. Bonds fell too. If you're in retirement or nearing it, this year's downturn is especially painful since there is less time for markets to recover before you need to tap your reserves. Wondering how best to navigate the financial waters when times are as terrifying as they are right now? Here are my do's and don'ts. Underlying all my advice is this message. Don't fixate on the short term. Be it scary or exciting, focus on the long term. Don't try to time the market. Though people think they can pick the best times to buy and sell stocks, I've seen far more investors guess wrong by buying high and selling low. So-called experts don't get it right either. Instead, try to control your behavior. When it comes to markets, the only thing you can control is you. Resist the all-too-human urge to sell in down markets and buy when markets are recovering. It may feel better in the moment to make those moves, but those impulses work against you over the long haul. Let time heal short-term declines. Do take some stock market risk. Pick a percentage of your portfolio that you will commit to stocks for several years. Think of it as a binding contract. I suggest putting it into stock index funds that own thousands of companies. Look for funds with expense ratios, annual charges that is, of 0.10% or less, which amounts to $10 or less for every $10,000 you have invested. The more you pay in annual charges, the lower your return is likely to be. But don't take unnecessary risk. Don't try to pick winning stocks, and don't buy mutual funds that own just a handful of companies or invest in only a single industry. That's likely to both increase your risk and lower your return. A 2018 study by Arizona State University Professor Hendrik Bessenbinder calculated that at any given time since 1926, the best performing 4% of companies on the U.S. stock market accounted for almost the entire net gain of the overall market. The other 96% earned hardly anything over nearly a century. The problem for you as an investor is that the top 4% is constantly changing, and you never know who and what the winners are going to be. If you pick stock odds, odds are they'll be among the 96%. Don't reach for unsafe yields. Virtually always, the higher the dividend or interest rate you've promised with a stock, bond, or other investment, the greater the risk you face. Companies paying high dividends often drastically cut them, as General Electric did in 2019, or go bankrupt, like General Motors in 2009. High-yield bonds are referred to as junk for a reason. But do balance your stock portfolio with safe bonds and other fixed income investments. One place to start is with U.S. government debt. Series I bonds, intended to provide some inflation protection for individuals, they are temporarily yielding an incredible 9.62%. Yields will drop if inflation does. Each person can buy up to $10,000 worth per year via TreasuryDirect.gov, and additional amounts each tax season, up to $5,000, by purchasing directly with a federal tax refund. You don't get your interest, however, until you redeem the bond, which you have to hold for at least a year, and there's a small penalty for redeeming within 5 years of purchase. Conventional one-year Treasury notes were yielding 3.24% as of early August. You can buy them through TreasuryDirect.gov, your bank, or a broker. Like I-bonds, they're exempt from state taxes. Insured bank and credit union certificates of deposit are also a good place to earn safe income. DirectAccounts.com and BankRate.com show the highest rates. In general, the longer the maturity of a bond or CD is, the higher its yield. But if rates go higher later, you'll have to pay a penalty to get out of that yield you're locked into. Although this is one of the worst periods ever for bonds, remember that high-quality bonds have less risk in a year than stocks do in a day. All you have to do is buy any one of the several investment-grade bond index funds on the market that charge 0.05% or less annually, and you'll own a slice of thousands of high-quality bonds issued by corporations and the U.S. government. Don't keep all your money in cash. That virtually guarantees you will lose purchasing power to inflation over the years. But do keep enough cash to sleep well at night. As Duke University behavioral economist Dan Ariel points out, you have to manage both your investments and your well-being. Put your stash, perhaps 3 to 6 months of living expenses, in an insured money market account or online savings account, where you could find rates north of 2.2% as of mid-September. And finally, do keep in mind the words of Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson: investing should be more like watching paint dry or watching grass grow. Markets will recover and capitalism will survive. Having an exciting life, just not in your investing. Our next article is from Kiplinger Personal Finance, and it's entitled "Good Reasons to Resist: Buy Now, Pay Later." Propelled by inflation and the pandemic-driven convenience of online shopping, buy now, pay later, or BNPL, services have become as commonplace as hand sanitizer in a shop entryway. Since 2018, the number of BNPL users in the U.S. has grown by more than 300% per year, according to a 2021 report by Accenture, a financial consulting and information technology firm. As the popularity of these programs has increased, fintech companies of all kinds have introduced BNPL products. How it works: when you make a purchase using a BNPL, a third party offers you a loan at checkout to cover your purchase, in some cases with no interest or additional fees. The list of BNPL independent providers runs long, many with unsubtle names such as Zip and Zilch. Affirm, one of the early BNPL players, went public in January 2021. In early February, Square parent Block acquired Australian-based BNPL service Afterpay. BNPL is popping up everywhere, from travel providers to cryptocurrency marketplaces. Several credit card providers are adding interest-free pay-later options for certain large transactions. Most BNPL plans split the cost of a purchase into four payments, typically made every 2 weeks. Companies send your purchase after the first payment, and there is 0% interest for the life of the loan, as long as you make payments on time. However, if you miss a payment, interest can increase to as much as 30%. Although they may not disclose it at the outset, many BNPL companies also charge a late payment fee. Some, but not all, report the transactions to credit bureaus, which could affect your credit score. It's a slippery slope. Though I personally avoid using BNPL, I understand the appeal of spending that doesn't feel like spending. I've traveled with friends who offer to pick up the bills for shared lodging and food, for example, who send a Venmo request for repayment later, and sometimes I've had to scramble to pay them. As with any easy credit, BNPL may entice you to overspend. Nearly one-third of people younger than 45, who are the target of a lot of the industry's marketing, say they sometimes spend more than their planned budget using BNPL, according to a recent study from J.D. Power, a consumer data research firm. And only about half of that group say they completely understand the payment method available to them, the study found. Despite the risk, there are times when BNPL can be useful. For example, if your washing machine or dishwasher breaks and you don't have the cash on hand to replace it. But understand the fees or interest you may incur if you miss a payment or make a late payment. Also, BNPL is a sort of novel product that doesn't have that regulatory protection around it that other similar types of financial products do, says Nadine Chambier, Senior Policy and Litigation Counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, a consumer group. BNPL is not ideal for multiple smaller purchases either, because the payment may be hard to track. For all of its problems, BNPL is likely here to stay, although not all the services will endure the test of time. Although I see how these payment methods could be useful, I'll only use one if I need to make a major purchase, and I'm certain I can afford to put the payments on auto pay. Our next article is from AARP Bulletin, entitled The ABCs of Part D Drug Plans, What You Need to Know to Get the Best Medicine Coverage from Medicare. The average monthly premium for a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan is only about $32. But if you become ill, that $32 insurance payment may be the most important check you send each month, given the high cost of some medicine. But Part D plans can be tricky. They not only cover different drugs, but they also charge differently for the same ones. Every year during Medicare's open enrollment period, original Medicare recipients and the roughly 1 in 10 Medicare Advantage enrollees who don't get drug coverage from their plan have the chance to switch their Part D coverage. Interestingly, the number of plans is in decline this year. There are 766 Part D plans nationwide, the second lowest since the program launched in 2006, the Kaiser Family Foundation reports. That still leaves plenty of options. Standalone plans this year at the state range from 19 in New York to 27 in Arizona. Experts say that even if you like your plan, it's worth seeing if you can find one that better covers your unique pill needs. Here are answers to the top questions about choosing a Part D plan. Should I look for the lowest monthly premium? It can be tempting given the big range in plan pricing, but don't choose a plan based solely on its cost, says Lee Purvis, Director of Health Services Research at AARP. It may be that it doesn't cover as many drugs. Annual costs could actually be higher. What's most important is that your Part D plan provides good coverage of the medicines you know you'll be needing. If you routinely take several medicines, paying a few extra dollars a month is more than worth it. If a plan covers all of them and requires low copays on each. How will I know what medications are covered? Drug plans all have lists, known as formularies, that detail the generic and brand name drugs they cover. These formularies are developed based on a drug's cost effectiveness and safety, usually by doctors and pharmacists working with your drug plans. If the drug isn't on the formulary, that means it's not covered. But the plan might cover a drug that is similar. You can ask your doctor if the medicine that is covered would work as well for you. That said, Medicare must cover all or nearly all drugs in 6 classes: antidepressants, antipsychotics, anticonvulsants, antiretrovirals for HIV and AIDS, immunosuppressants for transplants, and anti-cancer drugs. Plans also must offer a range of drugs for the most commonly used medications, such as beta blockers and diuretics. Each year, nearly open enrollment season, plans announce the coming year's formulary and cost. That's the time to do a careful review. Note that many drug makers raise prices in January and again in July, so what you see as a charge during open enrollment season could be different come the first of the year. What are drug tiers? Within the formularies, prescription drugs are divided into 4 or 5 groups. Tier 1. These drugs are usually generics and have the lowest out-of-pocket cost. Tier 2. These can be a mix of generic drugs and preferred brand name medications, ones that your insurance plan wants you to use, often because the plan has negotiated more favorable prices from a drug company. Tier 3, you pay more to get these preferred brand name prescriptions. Tier 4, the price is even higher for these non-preferred brand name drugs. And specialty tier, these drugs are priced the highest. They're often newer and highly specialized, like some cancer drugs. Consumers are charged a percentage of the drug price, usually 25 to 33%. What tier that a drug falls into can vary among Part D plans, and that means your copay could vary considerably as well. So when shopping for a plan, it's important to know not just whether your drugs are in the formulary, but also at what tier level. So how do I shop for a plan? Medicare has tried to make this easy. Go to Medicare.gov and navigate to Find Medicare Health and Drug Plans. Put in your zip code and choose Drug Plan, Part D. From there, it will ask you if you want to see your specific drug cost when you compare plans. If you choose yes, it will ask you for the name, dosage, quantity, and frequency of the medicines you take. Enter that information and the tool will give you specifics of the plans in your area. Which pharmacies can I use? Most of the time, any legitimate pharmacy, but check to see if the plan you're considering relies on preferred pharmacies, which might give you better pricing. And our next article, and hopefully we should be able to get this in on time, is entitled 10 million more people could qualify for mortgages thanks to new credit score rule. And this is from Money.com. An estimated 10.7 million additional people could qualify for mortgages thanks to upcoming changes to lender credit scoring models. Black households in particular are expected to benefit. On Monday, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA, announced that it will require mortgage lenders to incorporate credit scores from Vantage Score when evaluating potential borrowers. Lenders will also need to transition to a new version of the FICO score for the first time in nearly two decades. Critically, both the Vantage Score and the new FICO score will include information about a borrower's rent, utility, and phone payments. Requiring both credit scores when available will result in more borrowers that can be evaluated, said FHFA Director Sandra Thompson in remarks at the Mortgage Bankers Association annual convention Monday. The two scores, she said, should help lenders manage risk while also responsibly and sustainably expanding access to credit for borrowers with less robust credit histories. The FHFA sets the guidelines for loans that can be purchased by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, government-sponsored enterprises that support the mortgage market by buying loans from lenders. Requirements include a maximum loan size, currently $647,200 across most of the country, and a minimum borrower credit score of 620. Lenders often won't make loans that fall outside these conditions because they can't sell them, increasing their risk and cost. The FHFA hopes that the changes it announced will allow more people to qualify. However, FHFA did not set a deadline for the new policies to be implemented, describing it as a multi-year effort. Who benefits from the FHFA credit scoring change? The FICO score became a key part of the mortgage underwriting process in the 1990s. It brought efficiency and cost savings and was also shown to be a better predictor of on-time payments than some common metrics. However, FICO and other credit scores did not capture things like on-time rent or utility payments that previously had been included in a manual underwriting process. This admission has disproportionately affected black households, which tend to have less history of traditional borrowing. Lenders rely on credit history and credit scores to determine mortgage eligibility and loan pricing. But black households have regularly experienced greater difficulties accessing the same services that have allowed white households to build strong credit profiles, notes a recent Urban Institute report about the potential impacts of using alternative data in mortgage underwriting. FICA itself estimates 53 million people do not have enough credit history to be scored by the model currently used by mortgage lenders. Moreover, black households are disproportionately likely to have no FICA score or to have a score below 620. However, VantageScore estimates that it can provide credit scores for 37 million people that FICA does not currently capture. Of those, the company estimates 10.7 million will have a score of 620 or above, including approximately 4 million minority borrowers. This action today will enable millions more Americans to have access to mortgages because of VantageScore's more predictive credit score, and it will correct some historical imbalances we've had for conforming mortgages, said VantageScore CEO Silvio Tavares, according to the Wall Street Journal. And our last article for today is entitled Social Security Checks to Jump. This appeared in the AARP Bulletin. Analysts expect biggest benefit bump in 40 years. Social Security beneficiaries struggling with inflation will be helped by the biggest cost of living increase in 40 years, beginning in January 2023, experts predict. If nothing else happened, the increase would be 9%, says David Inna, creator of the independent website TipsWatch.com, which tracks inflation-protected financial instruments. Other experts put the likely increase between 8 and 11%. All say it will be the largest in decades. And this article will be edited due to time constraints today because we have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to listen to us next time. I'm Larry Wilson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.